hard acts to follow. Thank you very, very much, all of you. They're most illuminating. And I see it all from way, way, way back. And my first encounter with McNeice's poem was in the summer of 1943. Under the Wellingtonias, outside the entrance to Wellington College, where I was a boarder. And we were sitting on the lawn, and we were listening to poems read by our history and English master, and called Robin Gordon Walker, a brother of Patrick Gordon Walker, who was later the Labour Minister for Foreign Affairs. And Robin was very at peace, really, of the 30s, left wing. He wore green corduroys some days and purple corduroys on other days. And at Wellington College, we had this terrible military ethos. It was very refreshing to have such a teacher. And on the lawn, he read us those wonderful, memorable lyrics. Much more memorable, really, than Auden. I'm sure he read us Auden as well, but they didn't stick in my mind. Time was away and somewhere else. There were two glasses and two chairs and two people. With the one pulse, somebody stopped the moving stairs. Time was away and somewhere else. And particularly the other one of the same other poems of that period. I'm not used to finding this, but the sunlight on the garden was the one that stayed most resonance in my mind. Hardens and grows cold. We cannot cage the minutes within its nets of gold. Those poems did excite me, and I went down to the bookshop. It was W.H. Smith's in Crowthorne, where they did have some poetry. They had a little Faber book of modern verse edited by Anne Riddler, which I bought, one of the first books I bought at the age of 16. And McNeice was, of course, in that. But I don't think he impressed me as an Irish poet at that stage. And my later, I don't think he even influenced, unfortunately, he didn't influence my early work, which was very rhetorical and long-winded. And windy, and epical writing, ambitious length, in Connemara, in a house that had been previously occupied by Wittgenstein, who had to cross a barbed wire fence through a bog to go to the well for fresh water to drink. And that was a marvelous experience. I was thinking this morning with Valentine Cunningham's fascinating talk about the pastoralists of the 30s. I suppose I was a hangover from that, because there I was in going to this extreme remote promontory in search of the pastoral, of the ultimate, the bedrock of civilization, and with echoes of I don't know what of the legends of Tiernan Oak, I think, or Atlantis. It really didn't do me a lot of good. I was as poor as any ambitious young poet at that period had to be. to get any notice at all. But I think the poets of the 30s rather cheated on that. I'd like to raise that point in the question this morning, because I think they all had incomes when they went to Dorset or anywhere else, and they had girlfriends, and I don't know what, girlfriends who had incomes and wrote books. So it wasn't exactly back to raw nature or to equality with the peasants. I did for a long, long time have a belief that you would be rather dishonest in pursuit of poetry if you had an income that was much larger than that of a labourer's wage. But then, reminded later do you remember any of you in the listener, Mark Boxer cartoon of the Touch Paces having dinner in London, and she says to him, "Darling, it does upset me when the bill comes to more than a miner's take-home pay." Well, the MacNeice is very sensibly had a job and in a university and classical scholarship to back him up. And then later at the BBC. Now, he was quite right to be as dismissive of my early work as he was in this Stag. Bertie Rogers, who I hadn't heard mentioned at this conference, on the other hand, was extraordinarily kind and good-natured to me. He was drinking pint for pint with Louis at the time and doing broadcasts. And he said my epic reminded him of City of Dreadful Night. And I thought, what a dreadful comparison. But he was probably right. And MacNeice had my comment on him there, being in the green tweed suit and so on, and looking at the door, he was always inclined to look over his shoulder like that. And I got the feeling rather that he was seeing that there must be somebody more interesting than I could be talking to now, the young man who was so serious from the west of Ireland. And in fact, it was a nervous thing. He also had a way of talking out the side of his mouth slightly, that I remember, and a gesture with his hand and fingers, or I'm not sure it was left or right, just like that when he was talking. But he was always slightly evasive. But not that he was trying to hide anything by this, but this was, I think, what you were talking about his reticence, which I think is admirable quality too. And it was a protection of the poet in a man who was a public figure working in the BBC. Later, this middle age is bad for poets. Am I misquoting, friend?
The middle stretch.
This middle stretch, thank you, is bad for poets. I reviewed that volume for The Spectator, and I have never looked at the review, because I didn't particularly like the work. I thought it was. It was disappointing. And he revived wonderfully well at the end. I'd read you one short. His last companion was Mary Wimbush, an actor at the BBC. And when I met Auden in New York in 1971, having dinner with Barbara Epstein, Auden held this fantastic monologue, which I've included in The Kick, and it went on to how did we get on to the subject of witches? And quoting Auden, "My mother-in-law was a witch," he said, referring to the mother of Erica Mann, Thomas Mann's daughter, whom Auden had married in 1935, purely to make her a British subject. Then he said, and Louis's first wife is a witch, referring to Winnie's. I'll drink a bottle of champagne the day I hear she's dead. He was glad that Louis, in his last years, had found in Mary Wimbush, quote, the first non-violent woman in Louis's life. Barbara said she thought my mother was a witch, adding that she liked witches and liked my mother. I agree with my mother, the power of bewitching people. Well, was the case. And at the end of it, towards the end of his life, I'd met him on several occasions, and he had got an interest in the west of Ireland. It wasn't either, it was revived, resurrected, or whatever. And he was afraid, though, that Inishbofin was becoming fashionable. He wasn't sure he wanted to go to Inishbofin where I was running a boat service between Cleggan and Inishbofin, because he'd heard that Inishbofin might be becoming fashionable. I said, don't worry, it's all right. He came in the summer of 1962, and I took him on my boat, the Ave Maria, from Cleggan to Inishbofin, and and then we had drinks in the Pier Bar and so on. And I liked him very much. He was writing again, and again rather talking quite evasively. I didn't press him to tell me what he was writing or that. And he had booked a journey to Inishbofin for the following year, for the summer time, and that was a time in which actually he fell ill. With the bronchial pneumonia, from which he died on the day he was due to fly back from Ireland to England, as his sister Elizabeth later told me. And just before that visit, which was aborted by his illness, I received a copy of The Burning Perch gratis from Faber, as young authors used to do in those days, those generous days, and I was reading it with amazement that all those poems, beautiful lyrical poems, and all about death. Well, in a way. And there we heard that Louis had died. What a year! I think Sylvia Plath did some damage to that year. It was a very bad year. This 1963 was a bad year for poets. Starting with Sylvia's suicide. Didn't Rethke die that year too? Or was that?
It was a few.
Hmm?
I think it was.
Yes, and Bernard Spencer threw himself in front of a train, wasn't it? Another poet not well known. Anyway, there was, you can add them up. I'm sure you know better than I do. And it was very sad. I felt awful. You know, I just got my first book published by Faber in January. February, Sylvia dies, and all the rest follows. I think I'd like to read bagpipe music because I think it's one of the best, I think it is the best war poem of the Second World War written by any author at all. Bagpipe music, what is it? I beg your pardon. Excuse me, my age is telling against me. It's
Brother Fire.
Brother Fire. Why don't I ask for this? Brother Fire. Sorry.
Terrible.
Damn. I couldn't keep up this act for long. When our brother Fire was having his dog's day, jumping the London streets with millions of tin cans clanking at his tail, we heard some shadow say, give the dog a bone. And so we gave him ours. Night after night we watched him slaver and crunch away the beams of human life, the tops of topless towers. Of course, Louis was an air raid warden. London. Which gluttony of his for us was Lenten fair, who, mother naked, suckled with sparks, were chilled, though cotted in a grill of sizzling air, striped like a convict, black, yellow, and red. Thus were we weaned to knowledge of the will that wills the natural world, but wills us dead. O delicate walker, babbler, dialectician, fire, O enemy and image of ourselves, did we not on those mornings after the all clear, when you were looting shops in elemental joy and singing as you swarmed up city, block and spire, echo your thought in ours, destroy, destroy.